Chapter 8, Justice and Liberty, the Base and Measure of Democracy. In her left hand she holds her sword, but in her right hand justice holds scales, so that she may measure more carefully all ifs and buts. In one tray go the facts, and in the other go universal rights and the responsibilities of freedom. These must weigh most heavily in the scales of justice. Freedom means exactly what every member of our country club presumes it means. It is a complex of rights and responsibilities. We are safe and secure in our person and our property to go where we like in the commons, to earn income, to secure food, clothing, and shelter. We have access to education, to health care, to basic capital, and to justice. And we have, at least to some degree, a clean environment. Freedom and justice, rights, do not come without a cost. Their cost is responsibility. All who have had freedom and rights befall them owe the duty to strive for the same to befall all others as well. Most of us largely fulfill the responsibilities of our rights and freedoms, at least within our own country club. We pay the proper costs when we pay taxes that support our institutions of democracy. Not only is it a responsibility, but it is an honor and a privilege to support these democratic institutions by paying taxes. It's our schools, police departments, courts, legislatures, military, and hospitals that establish and protect our rights and freedoms. Each time we object to paying taxes, we fail in our responsibility and dishonor our duty. We also pay our dues when we call out those who deny their duty and decline to pay. And lastly, we pay the proper costs of the freedom that has befallen us every time we acknowledge, stand up for, promote, and strive to fulfill our responsibilities to accord universal rights and freedom to all. As well as her scales and her sword, justice has a blindfold so that she can neither favor the rich and powerful nor disfavor the poor and humble. Though at first, somehow her blindfold was askew and did permit her to distinguish by race and gender. Legislators never had such blindfolds, nor did crooked police. Perhaps justice should take off her blindfold, if only to protect us from selfish legislators and to watch crooked cops. She might take off her blindfold for another good reason. What justice needs is nice wheels. She needs to get around a lot more. She should get nice wheels with lots of room, like a ragtop coupe de ville, so that liberty may ride along shotgun. Together with justice's sword and scales, there must be room in the trunk for liberty's light and book. Liberty holds her light so that all may see her show the way, and she carries her book, inscribed upon it the date that she arrived in America. It is her book of account, setting out the proper costs of liberty and her ledger of payments due. Because this lady is neither free nor cheap. Presently, it is a very thick book of account, mostly because of her receivables. Justice and liberty are not just statues to remain in their place. They should both get around a lot more, and it is our duty to help them. They must go to Africa, where millions are starving while the rich and powerful take all the oil and everything else from above and under the ground. They take all the arable land and hoard the food for only those with money to buy. Across Africa, justice and liberty would be welcomed in many places as strangers. Justice and liberty must go east through the desert kingdoms and north through the steppes and the cold, dark forests. They need to cross the mountains to the teeming masses on both sides of the Himalayas. Then, after being away, liberty and justice might return to America and be properly recognized there for the first time for what they really are, the birthright of us all. All of us, everywhere. Justice and liberty had better be given safe passage, because they are Earth's most important citizens. If they are not yet yours, they will be soon. If we are wise, honest, and responsible, we will be sure to help them on their way. They are the personification of our rights and responsibilities, and before long, the date they came to your country will be inscribed in Liberty's book, too. As much as it is our responsibility to extend justice and liberty to all, this is also the way we properly celebrate them both. It's not their fault that America in so many ways has sullied their reputations that shall be restored to them as they are shown off to the whole world. We admire and proclaim justice and liberty because we think they are good. The absence or diminishment of either is bad. If it is bad for any of us, it is so for all. And we struggle with our institutions of democracy against that badness. Goodness is our reason. Well, good then. What is that? Goodness. Subheading. What good is goodness? Ethics is the philosophy of right and wrong conduct, of good and evil. It is always difficult to regard ethics honestly, but it is especially difficult when, like most of us, you have done wrong. Perhaps that is part of the reason ethics have fallen off the pop radar. That scientists are paid some regard in Canada was demonstrated by their muzzling by former Prime Minister Stephen Harper. Why muzzle what you do not fear? Lawyers are regarded, distinguished, then disregarded by opposing lawyers. But ethicists are not even disregarded. They could walk into the room and it would be like nothing happened. A rabbi, a priest, and a minister could walk into a bar with an ethicist and it would still be a normal joke. Ethics, besides being evident to every kid in second grade, embody a branch of philosophy that is similar to epistemology and jurisprudence, more honored now in the breach, if at all, as opposed to logic, which receives interminable lip service. Right and wrong are judgments even kids make. Often they make judgments on the basis of ideas of good and evil. It's good for big guys to look out for little guys. It's evil for big guys or gangs of little ones to be pricks and bullies. While we proceed in this inquiry, I hope that we will keep in mind at least what is evident to every kid in second grade. Never mind that when they get beyond the schoolyard, things look, well, different. It seems natural for us to prefer goodness over badness. Good stuff is better than bad stuff. Being treated well is better than being treated like shit. With a bit of time, the kid realizes that his sister's feelings are pretty much the same as his. With but a tiny leap more of imagination, he'll recognize the same thing about his friend's sister, too. Before long, we become civilized. That is, we recognize the equal expectations of us all and treat others the way we would like to be treated. When we consider ethics in our reasons for action, and even when we don't, goodness is a quality that is itself sufficient reason for our choices. There is good reason to prefer good. Good things work the best, last the longest, and just feel right. Bad things work the worst, except for the short term. They last their owner for the least time, and they feel shitty. Bad things just feel shitty. I can't explain it. It's just like human behavior. Good behavior works best, lasts the longest, and just feels right. Bad behavior is bad for everybody, except in the short term for its perpetrator. Whatever advantage comes of bad behavior is short-lived and feels so bad you have to drink, fight, and change friends frequently to enjoy yourself even a little. It comes down to basic schoolyard wisdom. Whether you're a good guy who can sleep at night or a selfish asshole up pacing the bedroom floor of your soul. A bit like our neighbors in the universe, we too have had much experience with the letting of evil run wild. It is why we establish institutions to protect our rights and freedom in our country clubs. But as we wander in the darker corners of our school grounds, or off the grounds entirely, our sense of right and wrong is constantly affronted. Precision bombs terrorize and obliterate innocent children every day. Signs that say private property separate the starving from vast amounts of what they need to stay alive. The food we waste and throw away would nourish a billion people daily. Ibid. Messes like the tar sands tailings ponds, more like Great Lakes, are left behind without a backward glance. Questions about who will clean them up hardly rating a shrug, until the task falls to the taxpayer. Let the Beaver Lake Cree eat exotic toxins in their fish and game. Let them drink poisoned water. That's the taste of other people making money. What value is there in an ethic that permits such results? Plenty of value for tar sands pricks. Not so much for their Fort Chip First Nations hosts, eh? Corporations and individuals alike blithely toss ethics utterly aside when they're provided with solid arguments designed to suit the convenience of selfish interests. Arguments like sovereignty, A free marketplace unfettered by regulation, private property, clean up your own backyard first, and in some quarters, arguments like, go fuck yourself, are offered in support of rapacious selfishness running wild. If we are to take the responsibilities of freedom and universal rights seriously, including the obligation to conserve our natural bounty, we are required to consider ceaselessly the good of others. Our obligations require us to weigh and measure competing views of good. They require us to practice ethics. Our institutions are built on the premise and with the intention that they will ensure our common good. A difficult task without knowing how to properly recognize that good. To succeed, ultimately, our institutions need only one thing more. Their terms of reference must expand from our common good to the common good. We must no longer be like the founding fathers of American independence, insistent upon our own rights, but somewhat less concerned with those of slaves and women. The women in the ragtop Coupe de Ville need to get around to every one of us, everywhere. Justice and liberty, if they embrace any of us, must soon embrace us all. America dreamed the right dream, just in a unstereotypically piddly way. It wouldn't cost any more than our global defense budget. Moreover, people who are cared for don't bust our balls. It's called sympathy. Although 250 years ago, Adam Smith thought we might recognize it in everybody, and Christ 1,700 years before him, sympathy has become more a stranger since Henry Kissinger rationalized. America has no permanent friends or enemies, only interests. What is the nature of sympathy that we shouldn't just disregard it as a useless sentimental artifact from our history? Like ethics, like friendship. Subtitle, Sympathy. Adam Smith's theory of moral sentiments is not quoted as much as his Wealth of Nations, though he thought the former considerably superior. And it is little wonder why. Moral sentiments makes a remarkable presumption about humans that all but obliterates Smith's usefulness as a defender of selfishness. His favorite work begins, "How selfish soever man may be supposed, there are evidently some principles in his nature which interest him in the fortunes of others and render their happiness necessary to him, though he derives nothing from it except the pleasure of seeing it. Of this kind is pity or compassion, the emotion we feel for the misery of others when we either see it or are made to conceive it in a very lively manner. That we often derive sorrow from the sorrows of others is a matter of fact too obvious to require any instances to prove it. For this sentiment, like all other original passions of human nature, is by no means confined to the virtuous or the humane, though they perhaps may feel it with the most exquisite sensibility. The greatest ruffian, the most hardened violator of laws of society, is not altogether without it. This philosopher, who is now most often relied upon to support the proposition that we need only pursue our own self-interest, identifies principles in our nature that interest us in the well-being of others for nothing in return except the pleasure of seeing it. He calls it sympathy. He attributed it to us all, and he expected us to find it as much in the rich or mean-spirited as in anybody. Perhaps another instance of this kind of sympathy in our nature is what we call love. We popularly celebrated such love when I was young. Curiously, it was Smith who most clearly set out the vision for our dawning age. Although Milton Friedman, Ayn Rand, Spiro Agnew, and Fred Trump misrepresent him in vain defense of selfishness, Smith observed, "The rich only select from the heap what is most precious and agreeable. They consume little more than the poor, and in spite of their natural selfishness and rapacity, though they mean only their own conveniency, though the sole end which they propose from the labors of all the thousands whom they employ be the gratification of their own vain and insatiable desires, they divide with the poor the produce of all their improvements. They are led by an invisible hand to make nearly the same distribution of the necessaries of life, which would have been made had the earth been divided into equal portions among all its inhabitants, and thus, without intending it, without knowing it, advance the interests of the society and afford means to the multiplication of the species. Smith tells us, the rich take the best, but they can't really eat too much more than the poor. Despite their selfish appetites, and although they only intend to indulge their own insatiable desires, still, they share with the poor. They are led by an invisible hand to share, as if the earth had been divided into equal portions among all its inhabitants. So, before the invisible hand had ever received the qualifier of the free market from its voracious proponents, there it was, through human sympathy, inspiring the rich to share magnificently with the poor. Smith's vision bears precious little resemblance to the pretense he is now alleged to support, much the same way Jesus is now being called upon to justify prejudice and bigotry against most sexual orientations, Muslims, liberals, atheists, to name sadly few. Smith's sympathy, in full context and not merely cherry-picked, actually supports, more naturally, a commonality based upon peace, love, understanding, and sharing. For instance, when I was much younger in Calgary, in a row of houses on Memorial Drive across from the Bow River parklands, dwelt hippies. Frank Hogan was a classic of the period. He had a house on Memorial, and it was known to be a place where a new way of looking at the universe and our place in it was available at less than $5. Frank didn't have much affinity for the psychedelic experience himself, but he enjoyed the company, and he enjoyed lots of beer. We called guys like Frank beerheads. His brother Jim, who lived with him, was an influence of a different kind. Jim Hogan has emerged as a highly regarded writer and speaker on communicating effectively in difficult areas that have become adversarial. For example, climate change. However, in 1969, Jim was the first person that I ever noticed use a peculiar word. It was in the title of a book he gave me, The Way of Zen by Alan Watts. Jim gave me another book by a strange fellow named Hermann Hesse called Siddhartha. They seem sort of beatnik. During the belated, in Canada, summer of love, there were lots of consciousness catalysts and empathy elaborators around. Zen rang a bell for me. I was knocked out by the compelling vastness to be found in every moment of doing absolutely nothing, but doing it vigilantly. Now I know even more completely the worth of that hunch. Watts, Hess, and Jim seem to get it all in an instant. It flows through all of us, an unending, brilliant welling up of awareness. Be still, yet still be. Alive to all instants. You can't get richer than that. A drunkard's dream. All you need do to get more than you ever dared dream is sweet fuck all. The sound of one hand clapping. I was all in. John of the Crossroads stirred like a medieval holy man. Hearing from on high the universe speak one word from all eternity, a word spoken in eternal silence, and in that silence still to be heard. Apologies to St. John of the Cross. It had occurred to me once, while pretty much embracing a tree, that I could feel the life coursing through it. It seemed to me that the tree could sense me as well. Either way, it too was alive. Wind blew through our leaves and our hair. It was miraculous, and it was everywhere. Tiny seeds take up the elements of air, water, soil, and sunshine, then organize them into whole new participants altogether, new makers of seeds, huge, regenerative, reproducing beings. And if trees aren't astonishing enough, what about the deer that walk among the trees? Or even more, the birds that perch in them singing, and then, when they care to, fly free? How astonishing is a human child who can dream dreams and then make them real? And what about this very being, so filled with astonishment? What is this instantiation of awareness we think of as our self? The inescapable fact that such creatures exist at all, and that by some miracle, we are, each of us, of that unique type that can dream, wonder, understand, explain, and possibly above all, though utterly deaf, write ninth symphonies. That inescapable fact was so extravagantly magnificent and filled one with such proper astonishment that the very dawning of the awareness might quite naturally have brought a welling up. All life is made out of the same stuff. Yet we have that inexplicable additional magic that we perhaps may feel it with the most exquisite sensibility. At that time, there were some fables turning up in the popular press pronouncing acid as an escape from reality. But on the incisive contrary, the experience of embracing the tree was, if anything, an escape to reality. We may quite properly be filled full and to overflowing with joy in every moment we live, in sheer breathlessness at life's fugitive nature, its capacity for anguish and ecstasy, disappointment and appointment. But if we swelled with emotion and welled with tears of astonishment every time we came upon a tree or met a child in the street, well, we'd never get into the fucking office. As sure as we have to step back from our rapture or anguish enough to get things done, we have also learned to habitually, instantaneously tamp down these wellings up at their faintest first hint that they will not overtake us and betray us to our fellows who would be afraid that we had lost our shit. Act like a man. Get real. Right? I don't think so. No, stepping back from rapture or anguish, though necessary for certain social or personal reasons, is more likely to be a step away from our true nature than one toward it. Disregarding our proper astonishment, as we do moment to moment to get along, is the actual escape from reality, our reality of abounding wonder and mystery that by some magic continues. We decided to explore this insight exceedingly and discover what it means to be a conscious being in the universe, what it must really mean, which does not always accord easily with what we were taught as children. It was a responsibility to ourselves and to all others as conscious creatures in the universe to embrace, enfold, and exalt such proper astonishment so that we might share it the better with all whom we encounter. Sympathy indeed. Sympathy may be the least of it. When I was a child, I learned to say the rosary at Grandma and Grandpa's house. The family would get on their knees in the living room. Well, at least one knee. Usually resting an elbow against the arm of a chair or a couch, each with our own holy rosary, we would recite the prayers in order as the beads dictate. The main thing is the Hail Mary, which is repeated 50 times, 10 times in each of 5 decades. The next most frequent prayer is the Glory Be, which ends with the doxology, the short hymn of praise to God. As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, world without end. Amen. It's also beautiful in Latin. Sicut erat in principio, et nunc et semper, et in saecula saeculorum. Amen. Since childhood, I had been truly awash in eternity and in infinity, among angels, with a certain all-powerful eternal being above looking out for me and for all of us. In the infinite universe abided eternal, all-loving, all-knowing perfection. Arthur C. Clarke wrote the story, and Stanley Kubrick made the moving picture, but if there's no audience, there ain't no show. Thanks, Bill Henderson. And we were all set in 1969 to see 2001: A Space Odyssey, the eternal fetus arising, vastly at peace, pure love floating infinitely among the stars and in the mirror. On black and white television, I watched a child wailing in fear and anguish on the war-torn streets of Hanoi in Vietnam. And I knew there was no difference between that child and me. Any distinction had to do with our experience, not with ourselves. Jesus said, The man old in days will not hesitate to ask a small child 7 days old about the place of life, and he will live. For many who are first will become last, and they will become one and the same. Thomas, verse 4. Why would we not be sympathetic? We are the same. We are the same thing. Conscious creatures, the universe's vessels of consciousness. Dare we grasp and embrace the implications of this? Or are we so special we may disregard that child in Hanoi? What are the limits of our sympathy? What should they be? Perhaps in this light, we might consider a place like India. Subtitle. Now, take India. When my friends and I arrived in New Delhi in 2005, I was the only one of us somewhat accustomed to India. There are two classes of everything in India. The best is called export quality. Then there is what everybody else affords if they can. Jim Hogan had been to Rishikesh, a city northeast of New Delhi, which is pretty much all export quality. From the world over, aspiring yogis and other seekers throng there to numerous world-famous ashrams, including that of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, where Jim had been a familiar in the 70s. But Rishikesh is like the San Miguel de Allende of India, that is to say, hardly exemplary of the society there generally. And Jim had never spent much time where the people of India shit in the street. So I suggested that on our first day we stroll up the streets of Old Delhi from the Red Fort 2 miles to the other end of Chandni Chowk Market, sometimes on the jammed and jangling boulevard, but also along the winding vastness of the side streets no wider than hallways, lined with closet-sized businesses. We could hardly see the sky because the air was so filled with the wires of pirated electricity, yet still, the air we breathed was frequently clouded to choking by generator smoke. The garlanded dead lay in the tiny streets, politely bowed to by passers-by, awaiting their stretcher to the freeing funeral pyre. People, a million at a time, in endless succession, swarmed the boulevard daily to acquire or provide goods decidedly not of export quality, but rather ranging from the dishearteningly domestic to the miserable. The crowd was so relentless as to assure that we need not worry about moving anywhere quickly. Along Chandni Chowk, children with snot-caked fingers and faces, all blackened like the cold eyes of their baby sisters, poked and grabbed. Unless we were stern. But how can any feeling person be stern in the face of such impoverishment? I gathered my friends for a quick huddle and told them what I had learned another time. 15 years before, while shopping for leathers on the other side of the city, near Connaught Circus in New Delhi, quite evidently a less humble side of town, I met a young woman who was nursing an infant. She looked to be about 30, but was probably 18. Mother's milk adorned her saffron sari, both sides. She was selling crude tourist maps at 5 rupees, which was then about 15 cents. I bought one and paid her 50 rupees, thinking I would help her and her son. I was immediately set upon by a dozen other women who cried, "I have children too, give me 50 rupees." Rafiq was a young Kashmiri man who hustled tourists, telling them that they must come to his uncle's shop. Of course, his uncle was any shop owner who would pay the pittance bird dogs like Rafiq received. A day after I had helped the young mother, she and Rafiq were in the same market area. She saw me talking with Rafiq, approached us, and asked Rafiq if he would translate to me. The woman told me that all money I gave her went to the beggar pimp, who held the franchise for her block. Much of the money taken from her by the pimp went to the corner cop. If a woman brought in 50 rupees, about $1.50, in a day, she was given 2 rupees, 6 cents. All people who begged or hustled, but did not remit, were violently beaten and had everything taken from them. Nobody refused to pay the cop. The best corners had the best beggars and the richest cops. People with crippling defects were at every corner, some by birth, but many more, it is said, by re-engineering after birth, the better a beggar career to be had. Wasn't it better to have one hand with some money than to be starving with two hands empty? She said that if I really wanted to help her, and I did, the best I could do was buy t-shirts and shorts for her infant. The beggar pimps and cops had less interest in such things. That night as I walked to my hotel at about 2 a.m., I saw the woman, among innumerable others, lying asleep on the sidewalk. She lay on her side, her left breast falling free. Her infant son lay on his back beside her, arms and legs splayed widely in his new outfit, red shorts with white piping and a white t-shirt, mother's breast to his lips. He suckled unconsciously, sleeping happily. As it was for beggars then, across town in Connaught Circus, so it was this day in Chandni Chowk, with my little prepared company. It became much less unsettling for my friends, Enid, Jeff, and Jim alike, to deny the children their alms, knowing they were depriving beggar pimps and cops more than they were disappointing the kids. Of course, the kids knew that too. Once it was clear that we knew the score, they laughed and carried on to torment others. Still, visitors may well find themselves off balance. Even knowing that it is not them who deprive these children, still, the children remain impoverished. Those who take, do take all, and then let the children sleep in the gutter for their trouble. People tried to sell small bits of waste lumber, chopped braids of hair, old punctured inner tubes, and pieces of string. Lepers and others with open sores were utterly disregarded by the throng. Single barefoot men pushed loads on carts that would fill a 3/4-ton pickup, and women carried bales of bricks upon their heads. Unlike Connaught Circus, here in Chandni Chowk, there were no cars, no trousers, nor ties. The few most fortunate were dressed in a tidy pajama or a sari. Most were in rags that were the same color as the dirt in which we all walked. More than half of us in bare feet. 25,000 choking three-wheeled putt-putts, each carrying too many passengers, jerked and honked, pointed up one side and down the other of the ancient boulevard, as if they intended to get anywhere at all through the whole vast mesmerizing clamor of jostling, teeming insufficiency. At the T-intersection, that was the west end of the boulevard, there was a building, a print shop that I had wandered into those years before. I'd found that we sahibs were oddly admired there, and the workers would permit us to climb up to their rooftop, three stories above the din, because we were, well, export quality. From their roof, 2 miles of millions spread off on the boulevard beneath, as far east as individual humanity could be discerned, then beyond, to the Red Fort. It truly looked like all the people in the world, a single creature comprising millions of cilia, eternally regenerating. We caught our breath, taking in the enormity below, which was less than 0.1% of India, and thus not the exception on Earth, but the rule. We gathered ourselves for retreat, the 2 miles back to the Red Fort and away. With at least 1 million others, we had kicked up and breathed the dust of everything that was in the road, much of which was not suitable for kicking, much less breathing. After their first day in India and that marvelous, disgusting, infuriating initial glimpse of life and disregard in Old Delhi, who wouldn't like a shower? Most of the millions with whom we had wandered that day would not be satisfied thus any time soon. That time 15 years before, I had been in such crowds in Bombay with Raju, who sold me leather jackets. He told me a bit about how that industry worked, that some of them jumped into vats over their breasts in mortally dangerous tanning chemicals, banned 40 years ago everywhere in the West, and stirred hides with their bare bodies so that, for some others of us, the white skin of cows was turned to burgundy, taupe, chartreuse, or mauve. We saw blue and red people walking home, green people. As we drove across Bombay, at every stop, and there were plenty, people obviously underwell tapped and scraped at the windows for alms. As I rolled down a window to give some pennies, Raju said, "Johnny, what are you doing? You cannot help them all. See how many there are? I can help one. She does not get to keep anything you give." The disregarded masses of humanity in India and those enslaved by absentee advantage takers the world over, by their very lives, seem to me to cry out. All wealth of the world comes from Earth. Ingenuity and labor produce it, but exceptionalism and avarice accumulate it, while hundreds of millions stagger, stumble, and starve. How are these hundreds of millions not our concern? Was Raju right? Are we excused our responsibility to our brothers and sisters because there seems too many of them? What is it to recognize a situation, then disregard it? Do we recognize our ignorance of human degradation? Are we even vaguely familiar? Cognize, the transitive verb, is to perceive, to become conscious of, to know. It is included in the verb recognize, to acknowledge or accept a specified factual or legal situation, to acknowledge or treat as valid, as existing. It implies looking twice, cognizing, then recognizing. Ignorance, the noun, is, but is not only, to not know. It includes the verb ignore, to refrain from noticing or recognizing. To ignore is to look twice also. It is to look at something, then to look away. In a world where hundreds of millions of people live in conditions worse than slaves and are denied rights as fundamental as clean water for their infants to drink, where selfish privateers are encouraged by profits to adopt the absolute minimum of human decency, where imaginary boundaries prevent us from protecting even the clitorises of our little sisters from mutilation in the blasphemous name of some so-called faith, and where government authority is routinely wielded gangster-like by hypocrites trumpeting democracy, freedom, equality, national security, sovereignty, and other crocodile values, we stubbornly imagine goodness was still a thing. Whatever else our species had learned by my lifetime, there is precious little known about how to fairly execute the founding principles of the United States of America, liberty, justice, equality. Precious less about how to be human, or why. What is known is summarily brushed aside as often as other things seem more convenient, and crushed in the press of our crusade to acquire and retain country club comfort for ourselves, are all the dreams and cares of the hundreds of millions upon whose misery our comfort depends, and who, with us, are all humans in the same degree. As we champion liberty and justice, another one of us dies every 4 seconds from hunger. I imagine that, if it is our nature to be sympathetic, this must somehow rub the wrong way. Perhaps we may henceforth be more ourselves.